Shalom, shalom, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Pulse of Israel here in our eternal and ancestral homeland, the land of Israel, in our eternal, beautiful, biblical, and indivisible capital, Jerusalem, since King David's time. Today, I am speaking with a... Let's see how you like my introduction here, Gabe.
All right.
A friend, a former mayor of a United States city, Bell Harbor in Florida, and someone very active in politics in America. And can we say publicly how you're involved right now for the 2024 elections? Gabe is working with Republican candidate Ron DeSantis in Florida. So very politically astute. And the first time actually that I think this is really important, was introduced to you was because of your outspoken activism in using your role as a mayor of Bell Harbor in America to speak about the growing anti-Semitism in America. And since then, we've been connected for a number of years. So welcome, Gabe.
Thank you so much. Just one correction. I don't work for DeSantis or for his campaign, but I'm involved in the campaign. I'm one of the National Jewish Outreach Chairs and kind of doing all the work that you do to help someone that you like that's running for president.
So thank you so much for that correction.
Yeah, sure.
And listen, I had the privilege of interviewing DeSantis a number of times, hosting him here in Israel back when he was an unknown congressman. Like, no one knew him at the time. I don't know, like 10 years ago. So I go way back with Senator Ron DeSantis. Why are you choosing to work with him? And I guess give us some background, because you live in Florida. You are a mayor underneath him, underneath his leadership. What's good about DeSantis?
Yeah, so first of all, I met him also. He was a congressman, and I met him when he was here 10 years ago. I was actually living in Jerusalem for the year with my wife and then three kids. We now have two more, you know that. So there were three kids, and I got a phone call out of nowhere from the famous Mati Dan from Ateret Kohanim,
right,
who said to me, Gabe, there's a congressman coming. I'm supposed to have dinner with him. I don't like speaking to political people. He's your age. He's coming with his wife. Can you please come? I don't even like speaking English. Can you do it for me, with me? So I said, sure. I didn't even know who it was. And we went to dinner.
He didn't even make the Florida connection. He had no clue.
He just said someone asked him to host, someone that was bringing him asked him if he can host. So he hosted then, and they had just, I think, acquired the hotel where Mark Twain stayed, where he wrote his book, and talked about how Jerusalem was like an empty
Not
wasteland.
Ron DeSantis. Mati Dan works for Ateret Kohanim. They purchased this building in the Old City. If you have never visited this historic building for Americans, because Mark Twain wrote his book there, yes. Yeah.
So DeSantis, we had dinner with DeSantis and his wife, Casey, and it was, first of all, an incredible dinner, and really substantive, and having these discussions. And usually, we've hosted over many years many members of Congress and elected officials related to Israel and just Zionism and things like that. And it was just another level. As a young guy who knew so much about the region, turns out he studied history in college, so he was kind of reminded me in that way, like when you had a conversation with like a Newt Gingrich, someone who just was a history book. And that's the amount of detail he knew about the Middle East and Israel and religiously as well. And I realized how grounded he was, from my perspective at least, in his Bible and in our Torah and the Old Testament, and just sort of how important religion was, how he connected that to modern day Israel and the importance of the United States having a relationship with Israel in a way that not so many people do in the Jewish community. There's only a small subsection of us that even make all those connections and that drives our everyday. And I felt really connected to him. And I walked out of that dinner and I told my wife, I'm like, this guy's going to be something. Either he's going to be president of the United States or something. I know at that point
he said this 10 years ago.
Yeah, he was 33, 34 years old. But it was just so obvious that there was something there. Maybe it was a hope more than anything. You meet someone so engaging. And if you fast forward just a couple years, 2 years, I became a mayor in South Florida, and I did the first anti-BDS ordinance in the country. We spoke about that. And Congressman DeSantis was working on anti-BDS legislation and efforts at the federal level. So we started coordinating and speaking a lot, and we did events together, speaking on panels together. And this was always sort of, he became like the go-to guy for the pro-Israel community in Congress. There were others, but he was definitely one of them. And then he continued sort of in that vein. People forget, but when Trump was elected president, the first thing he did a few months later vis-a-vis Jerusalem was he signed the waiver to push off moving the embassy to Jerusalem, which had been done every 6 months for the last 30-something years. And it was a huge disappointment for the community because he said he was going to move the embassy.
We were expecting it.
So I got a call from then Congressman DeSantis, and he said, I got to make a stink out of this. We got to keep the pressure on to get him to move the embassy. I'm going to go to Jerusalem and visit all the sites that the U.S. That the U.S. owns in Jerusalem. And then I'm going to call a hearing, and that way we can have I can have an educated discussion about it. I want to see the sites and see what's viable.
And I was with him on that trip, showing him the various places in Jerusalem.
So I know, because that was on a Sunday or on a Friday, because he called me and said, come with me. I said, sure, when are you going? He says, we arrive Friday, and we'll be there all day Saturday, and then Sunday night we come back. I'm like, I can't, it's Shabbat. And he's like, but it's for Israel. I'm like, that's not how it works. Like, I can't. So exactly, he came on that trip. He made a press conference in the King David, right, which you were probably there at. And then he called the hearing, and he started continuing that pressure. Then he ran for governor. And I, like you were saying, I was mayor. And
governor, not Senate, right?
Yeah, so he ran for governor. He became governor. He actually ran for senator first when Rubio was going to step down. And then he switched races and ran for governor. And
it was a smart move for him.
Well, yeah. He didn't want to run against Rubio. Rubio was going to step down, so that's why he started a campaign for senator. And then he went for governor, which fits him much better, by the way. And as governor, he's been fantastic. And I've seen it from the inside, like you're saying, as a mayor. Hendricks is a resident of the state of Florida. Florida, there's, you know, people, everyone can talk. You know, people like us who could sit on camera and speak, right? People can write things. But at the end of the day, people vote with their feet and people make decisions. You just see how they act. And Florida is leading the country by a lot in net migration. Everyone's moving to Florida. You know, people, the antis will say, well, it's because it's you have no income tax. Well, we haven't had no income tax since time immemorial, right? So what's changed? And what's changed is local and state government has become overbearing on citizens and on residents all over the country in some fronts. And then in other fronts have let their cities and states run amok with crime and different issues on, you know, the quote unquote culture wars, which is really affecting people's lives in the sense that you're sending your kids to public school, especially, and you don't know what these teachers are teaching them. And this is not something that was being taught 5 to 6 years ago. Suddenly you have all these activists and the teachers feel emboldened that they can cross the line and push their personal agenda. And it's not about what they do with their lives, you know, whoever it is that are speaking that. Everyone can do whatever they want from my perspective, but don't push it on our children, right? And those were the issues that were happening all over the country. And because of that, people just started moving to Florida. I mean, they started with the COVID because he was the first governor to really
open up.
There were some others that in less populated states, but sort of in the populated states, the first one to really open up. But then he just made it what the state is today. And, you know, now that he's running for president, if we can replicate that for the country, it would be fantastic.
So I wanted to focus now on the Jewish component, because I grew up in New York City, born in the 70s, lived in the 80s, right? And back then, the vast majority of the Jewish population, especially the religious population in North America, lived in New York City. Florida was a nice community. I remember visiting for winter vacation. It was always wonderful and a nice, vibrant Jewish religious community, but much, much smaller. I was just there a few months ago, first time in decades. Many New York Jews, many have migrated to Florida. I mean, as a kid, Florida was basically Miami, and Hollywood was the north of the religious communities. Now it's a four-hour drive of spread of Jewish religious communities down in South Florida. And I believe one is the reason for COVID, both for and then economic, but also I think anti-Semitism is growing in New York State. The culture war is seeping into the Jewish schools and in the New York, New Jersey area. And a lot of Jews are, and anti-Semitism is growing. So how would you express like a difference in feel for the Jew, both in terms of Israel and in terms of just the growing anti-Semitism, the difference between experiencing a Jewish life today in Florida as opposed to New York, where there's still plenty of Jews, even though little by little they're moving down to Florida.
So I'll talk to both things. So first of all, speaking specifically about Florida, another statistic is Orthodox Jews are moving to Florida at the highest rate, more than anywhere else in the country, by a lot. And you can just see it when you're there. There's new schools opening every day. There's just two new high schools, one last year and one this year, opening up in Miami-Dade County.
Unbelievable.
And there's waiting lists for all of them. So there's...
And I remember when I was a kid, the only one was basically Hebrew Academy.
Hebrew Academy, then Hillel opened, and now there's several more. And then in Broward County and Palm Beach County, there's even more. And then everything that comes with it, right? New synagogues, new... new restaurants. And really, Florida is just this beautiful balance for the Jewish community, where in South Florida, especially, the majority of us, me included, are immigrants from other places. My family came from Argentina. Everybody came from somewhere. It's a different feel. There's a lot less political extremism on either side, honestly, in Florida. Everybody's a lot more welcoming.
Relaxed. Yeah.
And I know that's different than what's portrayed, you know, the quote-unquote Florida man, all this nonsense that's in the media. I don't know if you've seen it.
No,
you've seen
it. Okay.
Because there's always this backlash. Whenever you succeed, there's going to be backlash. And you see that in the state of Florida. Most of it's just media, and it's fun for clicks. So definitely there's a lot happening. If you compare it to other cities, like in New York City, which, by the way, has the largest population of Jews in the world, including any city in Israel. There's almost 1.5 million Jews in New York City. And the largest city in Israel is under 1 million, and it's right. Not 100% Jewish. So the most populous Jewish city here is it depends how you, if you, you could be, it could be Tel Aviv if you include the Gush Dan region. But anyways, none of them touch New York City. No one gets near to 1.5 million. I could say, you know, I've done a lot of great work with Mayor Adams in New York City. Anti-Semitism is not a partisan issue. So, you know, that's one issue that I work with everybody on every side, anyone who wants to work on it. And I can say clearly that Mayor Adams has done everything that you can do as a city leader to try to quell anti-Semitism. He stands with the Jewish community. He pushes the anti-Semitism definition. He works with, they do an incredible thing with the NYPD in the beginning of every Jewish holiday season, where they invite all the Jewish leaders with the NYPD and they talk about the holidays and what's the security apparatus going to be. Really, I've never seen anything like it. The problem is the Jews don't live in a vacuum. So we're living in a time and in a city where there's crime is rampant in New York City, and there's a lot of homelessness, and you have the migrant issue in New York City, which is causing a lot of issues as well. And we're not immune from it. And then on top of it, we have crazy divisiveness happening in the United States. Israel, everyone here thinks it's unique, where there's a divided society right now. In the United States,
it's much worse.
Different situation, but it's equally as divided. And there's not really a sense of a common mission that we have here,
right.
That you have here, right. In Israel, that there is here in Israel.
Right.
And I think I'd love to talk about that a little.
Hopefully.
But at the end of the day, people are moving to Florida for all those reasons, because, you know, the mayors there also are working on this. The governors, you know, this last year, the governor passed the toughest anti-Semitism legislation in the country. He just gave $8,500 per student as a scholarship that goes to any private parochial religious school.
Oh, wow.
So,
that's the charter?
No, it's a new program right now. It's a full,
totally different.
Totally new program. And everyone can apply and get an $8,500 scholarship from the state to go to private school. And by the way, at the same time, he increased salaries for public school teachers. And, you know, Florida has a huge surplus, which is very unique in compared to other states in the country. So, look, it's not a perfect comparison.
That's without the income tax.
That's without the income tax. We have property tax and we have sales tax.
Right. So it's interesting because, like you said, like a lot of Orthodox Jews are moving down to Florida. And first of all, show is Pulse of Israel. I'm always trying to tell the Jews guys, come home to Israel. And anyone who I know who's moving to Florida, I'm like, you know, this is you're one step closer to coming to Israel. Okay, you're leaving New York, you're going to Florida, but that's the way station. You're on your way.
Allah has daily flights 6 days a week.
That's right.
At 12:50 p.m. You arrive here the next day at 7 a.m. So,
but let's touch upon the divisiveness issue. And I'm glad you said you wanted to talk about it, because I'll introduce you into the conversation by bringing up my conversation with Dave Rubin. Right, I had a quick interview with Dave Rubin when he was here in Jerusalem a few months ago, and I asked him what he has to say to us Israelis based on the divisiveness in America, and he said,
"But I would say you guys have something absolutely incredible beneath all of the politics that unites you, regardless of whether you're, you know, a Reformed secular Jew or an Orthodox Jew. There's something culturally that brought us all back here, and I would include myself in that as someone that's here right now." And America's really struggling because our multiculturalness and our melting pot, which has actually been the strength of America, has really been upended by the woke and the modern left and all of these things. And we have a much harder path to get back in the right way, because there were so many people with so many different traditions. You guys have a much narrower version of it. That means the way that maybe you strayed can be corrected a lot more easily than what we have. And I would say if you guys can correct it first, then that would be a blueprint that we could use in the United States, and that would be a great gift that Israel could give America.
That's a great point. So what's your say in terms of talking about this whole issue?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And Dave is a friend. And when we're talking about Israel, the scary part, I've been here for 2 weeks right now, and I'm, you know, I'm very well informed on the judicial reforms and on the
culture. You're a lawyer. He's a lawyer.
And on the cultural issues. I've written about it. I've spoken about it. And, you know, the part I haven't really written or spoken about, because it's not my place. I don't live here in Israel as much as I spend a lot of time here. But, you know, is the undercurrents of the different sects within Israel, whether it's the, you know, Ashkenazis in one part of the country, the ultra-Orthodox in other parts, the Sephardics, the socioeconomic differences and political differences of those folks. And those are really the undercurrents. That's really the only way to truly understand the level of tension, because any subjective viewer that reads, for example, this week, the reasonableness clause that was passed, the standard that was removed, essentially, not even from all reviews, but saying that the Supreme Court cannot use a subjective reasonableness test of what a reasonable government would do or not do in overturning decisions made by the Knesset. Anyone who sees that would say, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Or let's say people that don't and want the court to have some flexibility would say, oh, I wish that would stay. But nobody that looks at that subjectively or in a vacuum, to be fair, would say that would be a cause for hundreds of thousands of people to be marching on the streets or calling for civil war, God forbid, or you know, for the level of hysteria that you're seeing. Right. And in fairness to those who are so upset about it, you have to look at it in context. And then the question is, what's the context? The scary part of it, and we're glad to dive into it or not, but the scary part of all of it is what we spoke about before, is the difference always between the state of Israel and other countries. The question has always been, what's the magic? Why is it? You know, so the book Startup Nation, you know, by Dan Senor and Singer was written, and it was, you know, this incredible thing, which basically was like, their answer was, you know, the reason why this country has been so successful is likely because of the military culture and the Jewish mother and, you know, that sort of thing. But I think it's something a lot bigger than that, you know, without even talking about the fact that the state of Israel itself is a miracle and God controls the world. But if we're talking about things that we can control and see here, you know, is the common sense of purpose and mission, where everybody's driving in the same direction or rowing in the same direction, is the most powerful thing that a nation or a society could have. And what's really scary in looking at the undercurrents and the discussions from pretty high level people during the judicial reform fights here is statements that are the polar opposite of that. Just like full, you know, it's Tisha B'Av tonight and tomorrow. Like, it's always been philosophical, the idea of Sinat Chinam, like baseless hatred, in which people say was a reason for the destruction of the temple, which I always thought was, all right, that's a cop-out. Like, baseless hatred, that's not why, that's a nice lesson. But now you see it, and you're seeing people, you know, yesterday, someone pretty high level, a former staffer for someone very high level on the left here, tweeted something about, you know, why are we worried about people not showing up to the Air Force if now we're going to make prayer and study of Torah an essential part of being in Israel? Our prayers will protect us, you know, being sarcastic. I mean, that's like real disgusting rhetoric that'll divide the country. And it's like, I wish they saw the full puzzle. And maybe because I'm on the outside a little bit, I can, and I love Israel as much as anybody here, is in where, you know, the people want Israel to stay a democratic state. Everybody does. Without the ultra-Orthodox, the numbers aren't even there. So we need, we as a society, Israel as a society, needs the ultra-Orthodox for two reasons. One, to keep a Jewish identity of the country, as defined by Ben-Gurion, who is not a religious guy,
right,
but also just by sheer numbers, right? Because if they're the reasons why, they as a group are the reasons, the sole reason why Israel has a safe democratic majority in Israel. So there is a value there. Then you take the religious Zionist community, you know, approximately 50% of officers in the military, more than that in the combat units, are religious Zionists. You take them out, then the military will likely be weaker, definitely. Or if they stop settling in Judea and Samaria and in areas like that, the whole country will fall, because people don't realize how close that is to the areas on the West Coast in Israel, where people live this beautiful startup nation life. If there weren't people living just down the street, you know, it would be a much more different situation. And all those folks also need the Jews that are in Tel Aviv that are driving the engine of the economic engine. Right. So it's really all of it together. And somehow today that's being lost. And I'm hopeful, because I'm a eternally optimistic person. I'm hopeful that that's going to come back. And that's, I think, what Dave was likely talking about, and that it'll come back at some point when the hysteria dies down and the leaders on all sides start focusing on that. Like, hey, we can have a lot of fights, but remember, we're all going in the same direction, and we have to continue to go in that direction.
No, 100%. And I think I'm not even in the mindset of saying it's going to come back. I think it's still here. like you mentioned before, the media likes to pick up on stories, and the media is a big part of this whole story playing a side. Like even in America, it always focuses on the extremes and creates more tension and more of a story out of things than they actually are. Because I'll give you the example of two different videos. One video that all the media showed, and one video that the media didn't show at all, that's going viral on the internet, right? And obviously, the one that's going viral on the internet is the one that actually tells the real story, but the media is not showing. Okay, obviously, if someone spits on someone from the right, the left doesn't make a difference, that's going to hit the news. Someone hits someone, that's going to hit the news. All the news, oh, horrible hatred. This person screamed at the other person, horrible hatred, where's the unity? What's the video that the media didn't show? And that's going viral. And this is fabulous because this is all real. You know, like I know, you go to the train station, right? Whether in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, there you go up the escalator and you go down the escalator, right? So on Sunday, was it Sunday? On Sunday, the anti-reform protesters were leaving Tel Aviv and going to Jerusalem for their protest. And the pro-reform protesters were going to Tel Aviv to their protest. So there was a video of one of the train stations where you had everyone going to the anti with their Israeli flags going down the escalator. This was Tel Aviv. And then you had the pro-reform with their Israeli flags going up the escalator. And in this little 10-15 second video, you see them smiling at each other, singing at one another, shaking hands. Like, that's the real Israel.
Yeah.
That's the majority of the people. On the extremes, there are people creating the division. But the unifying factor, I don't think I'm being optimistic. I think I'm being a realist, seeing majority of the people were one. We're a passionate people. We're passionate about our identities. We're passionate about our country. We're passionate about our thoughts. So everything is getting the extremities are getting the more attention. And unfortunately, people are pushing it, including the media. But in terms of us, we're still there. We're so one, and we're going to get out of this when all the
there was another down. Video that's going viral yesterday of a social media, you know,
yes.
guy in a modern guy, not a religious guy, a secular guy in a mall in Tel Aviv.
Yes.
And he would ask people, you know, what's your position on the reform? And whatever they said, he would say he's the opposite.
Right.
And they would stop. He'd say, can I have a hug? And they were like, sure. Everybody said, sure. And he gives them a bottle of wine and thanks them.
Yeah.
And then he tells them, look, I'm not for or against. I just want unity. And it's going viral. And I agree with you. You know, unfortunately, you know, I work a lot with companies in Tel Aviv, and I get to live in that space a lot. And I see the anger, and I don't want to dismiss the anger. I don't want to dismiss it and just, you know, belittle it. I don't agree with it. I see it as a groupthink, you know, where everybody's kind of come together and this is the thing to do. And everybody, I've spoken to, I don't know, 30 people about it in detail, and everybody has a different reason they're upset. There's not one cohesive thing. And, you know, people use the term democracy and such, but you know, the way, or, you know, now we have to fight for these many years. The way you fight is to vote. And right. To get good candidates that you
throw the bums out. That's democracy.
Yeah.
You don't like who's in, you have to throw them out, bring someone else in. Right.
Yeah.
100%. All right. So let's go back, and we'll end with this with this topic, because something you were very involved in, I'm sure you're still involved in. How are things developing in terms of the anti-BDS resolutions within federal government, within states in America? Because that's something that you very much were in the beginning of. And I think it's love to hear the status where it's
at. So I spend still most of my time dealing on anti-Semitism issues.
Wow.
Most of my free time, whatever that means. I can first speaking more broadly about it. Anti-Semitism continues to be through the roof in the United States. And just to tie it to our last topic, when people say, you know, how are the Americans responding to this? Despite the article that came out this morning about the generic statements that some organizations came out with, in general, the American Jewish community that's pro-Israel, right? There's a part that's not. Those are the extremes. But everybody else, you know, whether they care or don't care about the judicial reform, it's not driving or affecting their love or support for the state of Israel in the least. And then the question is why? You know, one of the reasons is because the anti-Semitism is through the roof right now. And a lot of it comes vis-a-vis Israel, right? And they use Israel as the excuse for the anti-Semitism, which is why the anti-BDS work is so important. But it's really at levels that we haven't seen in decades, and it's getting worse. And yes, it's perpetrated by, you know, by the media and by hysteria and by social media and, you know, sort of everything today. You put it in the blender and it explodes. And then people say, well, that's just perception. But in a way, perception is reality. And the attacks are actually up as well. So in all perspectives, anti-Semitism is up. And the fight is really broadened. You know, the anti-BDS stuff in and of itself is pretty enshrined in most of the states. In the federal level, it's not there, nor will it, because there's a lot of issues, I think, in the federal government. But overall, by the way, Congress has been very, very divided. And here they talk about consensus. In the U.S., we don't get consensus on anything. It's always partisan. Every vote is partisan. It's not, it's, you know, here that the vote passed 64 to zero when it's, you know, 61 is a majority. They got 64. That's more than we usually get in the United States. So everything is divided. The fight today is mostly about the definition of anti-Semitism and using the IHRA definition. And at first it was very easy. You know, in Bell Harbor, we were the first government entity to pass that in the country. Wow. And then I've worked with states and cities all over to try to promote it. And in the beginning, it was very easy. You know, it has a definition of anti-Semitism, which includes the part that's quote-unquote controversial, although it shouldn't be, is the three Ds that Natan Sharansky came up with of why, when anti-Zionism becomes anti-Semitism, and it's delegitimization, demonization, and double standards. And, you know, using the term generically, the left, the far left, is now starting to oppose it strongly because of that. They always have, but no one's really listened to them on it. They say it's a First Amendment issue. It doesn't even talk about First Amendment. Say, you can say it. You're just anti-Semitic.
Right.
But it doesn't mean you can't say it. So it has nothing to do with First Amendment at all. It's just a definition, and it could be used as a tool in different ways. And it's been a rough go getting it passed in states. In the beginning, it was easy, and now it's getting harder and harder.
Really? Because of the growth of the left politically at the state level?
The growth of the left at the state level.
Wow.
Democrats under the age of 30 in politics, you know, statistically, are not favorable, you know, don't have a favorable opinion of Israel. The whole thing we've been looking at for years of intersectionality, where all the different groups on the left have come together to try to fight each other's fight, It's been effective.
Except anti-Semitism.
Oh, no, the Jews are on the wrong side of that.
Right,
ledger.
Right. That's always the hypocrisy of the...
It's good versus bad, strong versus weak. If that same movement would have come out 30 years ago when Israel was a weaker country, Israel probably would have been, and the Jews would have been on the correct side, the safe side of the ledger. But now that Israel is strong and the Jewish people, again, are strong in the United States and have good positions in government and in the economy and are doing great things, you know, we're the most charitable group by far statistically in the country. All these things where we affect society, despite our very small size of, you know, less than 6 million Jews in the United States out of over 300 million people, you know, the impact is felt. So the anti-Semitism is through the roof, and we're working through it. It's BDS, it's the anti-Semitism definition, it's anti-Semitism commissions that are being formed. I'll just touch briefly, you know, the White House did something that in practice, in theory, should have been great. You know, they created this anti-Semitism task force, came out with a report. But, you know, a few really scary things came out of it. It shows the politicization of such important issues. I said earlier that anti-Semitism isn't a political issue. It's not a partisan issue. But for that task force, it turned out to be anti-Israel, anti-Zionism wasn't even in the report, even though it's such a significant portion of the anti-Semitism we've seen in the United States. They included CARE, the Council for American-Islamic Relations, as part of their effort to combat anti-Semitism. There's a group that's a known anti-Semitic group who's done some real harm. They've included some of the far left groups in there as well, that it does everything they can to be anti-Israel. Now, of course, I'm not saying the president is anti-Israel or anti-Semitic. He's not. But the problem is the staff and the people around him and the younger generation in those political spaces, there's a lot more anti-Semitism. And really, anti-Semitism is becoming more normalized. You can get away with it as long as you mask it a little bit with anti-Israel isms on top of it, or, you know, you tie it together with other things. You can get away with it in society today in a way you couldn't 5 years ago.
And I think also on another scary level is, while you're bringing up great examples of its existence on the left and the growth on the left and even taking over the Democratic Party as a party, it's growing on the conservative right also. And I think more in terms of a value-based and partners on a political level, so many, and I've tried talking to Republicans about this, saying, guys, watch out. This is developing little by little. It's talked more out loud at some conferences. And that's a scary thing where it's going to be one day it's going to be a tsunami if we can't stop it. But from the left, from the right, from the Muslims, etc.
Yeah, I was speaking about it. Look, on the right, there's anti-Semitism everywhere, by the way. So there's anti-Semitism on the right as well, on the far right especially, you know, where you're talking about the white supremacist groups and such. You know, they don't really have a home politically, thank God. So they bounce around. So for, you know, sometimes people say, well, they support DeSantis. And then DeSantis does something pro-Israel or against anti-Semitism. They say, oh, he's owned by the Jews, and they put him on their blacklist, right? They bounce around everywhere. The good news is they haven't had political penetration in any significant way.
Right. And it's not accepted politically by the party leadership, as opposed to the Democrats.
We've had Marjorie Taylor Greene say some ridiculous anti-Semitic things before, and, you know, the RJC and all these different groups have spoken out against her, and you know, she's had a little bit more of a shelf life than many of us would want to see, me for sure, speaking for myself for sure. But it's a different level on the political side. You know, the violence and such is coming from the right. So it's just as important, where you have to protect your synagogues and your schools. That's coming from the far, far right. They don't have a political place in America right now. Will they one day? Hopefully not. But right now they don't have one. And we are doing a good job keeping them out of the party, generally speaking. There's always exceptions, but generally speaking, we're keeping them out. On the left, they're being welcomed and they're being strengthened, and every day they have more and more committee assignments, more responsibilities. You look at new candidates, who's being funded as new candidates on the left, and almost across the board, you know, in every race, there's going to be one candidate that's rabidly anti-Israel, and then right beneath that, anti-Semitic. And that's very dangerous. We have to deal with both of them. We have to deal with all of it. And we can't rest, and we just got to keep pushing forward. And the last thing I want to say on anti-Semitism is, as Jews, we can't let it define us. We have to fight back every time, but that can't be who we are. Our identity isn't a group of people who fight against anti-Semitism. Our identity is a group of people who succeed and thrive despite the anti-Semitism. Yep. But that's not who we are.
Yep. And I guess on that note, the most important message that I always try to give over, especially when I talk to the younger generation, collegiates and high school kids, is saying, guys, you guys are growing up right now in a very progressive environment where all the language you're being taught, even in schools, even in Jewish schools, about the power divide, et cetera, oppression, yada, yada, yada. I'm like, we're not playing the victim Olympics. We're not in that game. That's not what defines us. I go, but look at your history. Be proud to be a Jew. We're the most persecuted people of all of history, and indigenous people. And I always ask them, how many indigenous peoples have returned after thousands of years to be sovereign in their ancestral homeland with their holy sites and be able to stand up and defend themselves in their homeland again? I'm like, how many? And they're like, it's only one. Only us. Only the Jewish people. We are the celebration of humanity. Feel proud to be a Jew. Don't let anyone, don't let the anti-Semitism, don't let all the anti-Israel stuff get you distracted. Be proud of being a Jew.
For sure.
So thanks for everything you're doing, Gabe. Thanks, wonderful having this this update, this schmooze with you. Thank you for the great work.
Thank you so much.
Everyone, former mayor of Bell Harbor, Gabe Groisman, out there on the front lines in so many ways, both for all Americans, Floridians, and for all of us Jews. Signing off for another episode of The Pulse of Israel here in our eternal and ancestral homeland, the land of Israel, in our eternal, beautiful, biblical, and indivisible capital, Jerusalem, since King David's time. Shalom, everyone. Thanks for watching.
Pulse of Israel, frontline videos from the Holy Land. Support our work by donating today.